This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue to monitor the dismantling of fundamental constitutional protections and laws by the Trump administration.
We're joined by Dalia Taha, policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work.
We then speak with author and anthropologist David Vine about his recent book, Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World.
Our guest contends that more than 800 U.S. military installations scattered across foreign lands are not merely symbols of strength, they're often sources of harm, fostering anti-American resentment and propping up authoritarian regimes.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
America is in the midst of a constitutional crisis. Over 200 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration during his first 100 days in office, resulting in over 100 injunctions and stays as Trump lays waste to fundamental constitutional protections and laws passed by Congress. On his first day in office on the second term, Donald Trump had the audacity to sign an executive order claiming he was, quote, restoring freedom of speech. Instead, his administration is systematically destroying the right to speak freely, to write freely, to dissent freely, and to protest freely. Trump ordered the elimination of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in both the public and private spheres, and targeted several leading universities, threatening to withhold federal funding for indoctrinating students with woke ideology, and for failing to combat anti-Semitism, by which he means criticism of Israel. He shut down the Voice of America and the Smithsonian Museum. He canceled the security clearances, government contracts, and access to federal buildings of several prominent law firms because he didn't like the clients they represent. He even excluded the Associated Press from the White House because it refused to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. In one of the most egregious violations of the First Amendment, the Trump administration canceled foreign student visas and deported legal permanent residents claiming their constitutionally protected campus protests were contrary to U.S. foreign policy interests. Fortunately, brilliant lawyers, courageous judges, and public interest organizations are fighting back. To discuss these critical issues, we're joined today by Dalia Taha, a policy manager at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where she leads the First Amendment and civil liberties work. Dalia is a Palestinian-American Muslim. Prior to joining MPAC, she served as project manager at the Texas A&M Foundation, where she researched and analyzed maternal health policy. At MPAC, Dalia works to champion policies and initiatives that uplift and advocate for the Muslim community nationwide, with a particular focus on protecting the First Amendment, academic institutions, and the next generation of American Muslims. I am particularly pleased to have Dalia with us today because she and I are about to launch a podcast called Rapid Response, sponsored by MPAC, in which we will examine the struggle of students and community members, Muslims, Jews, and allies, who have been targeted by the Trump administration for expressing political views in favor of Palestinian rights and sovereignty, which the government is seeking to suppress. Dalia, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Steve, for that amazing introduction and for having me on Law and Disorder. I'm very excited to be here today.
We're excited, too. Let's begin with what's happening on campuses. Over the last year, pro-Palestinian students across the country have been arrested, doxxed, suspended, and even threatened with deportation. How is MPAC defending the First Amendment rights of students and faculty members who are being silenced or punished simply for speaking out against Israel's assault on Gaza.
At the Muslim Public Affairs Council, we've made it a top priority to defend the civil liberties of pro-Palestinian students, faculty members, staff who are facing unprecedented repression for their activism. From day one, we've been on the ground in every capacity, whether it's at the universities themselves, in the courts, with organizing with other organizations to be able to best address this repression. We're tackling this from quite literally every angle, from a legal, institutional, political angle. And we've launched a nationwide campaign to expose how universities and public institutions are violating these First Amendment rights. We're publishing detailed reports, statements, and we're supporting, most importantly, these impacted students and faculty member. And we're pushing for these formal investigations into these abuses. We've also been fighting to ensure that academic spaces remain safe spaces for dissent, because criticizing a foreign government is not a form of hate speech, and expressing solidarity with Palestine is not a crime, and that's something that we heavily emphasize. We've taken a very bipartisan, nonpartisan stance on this, working with stakeholders across the board, whether it's Republicans and or Democrats, saying the First Amendment is the First Amendment, and we have to uphold the First Amendment. We have to uphold our civil liberties and our democracy, because it doesn't just start with the Muslim or pro-Palestinian community. We are essentially guinea pigs, right? They start with us, and then it trickles into other communities. So we've been heavily emphasizing that in this nationwide campaign, which is a lot of emphasis on public affairs, exposing what's happening and working with external stakeholders to be able to address it.
Ask a follow-up to that, because we've seen footage of police brutally dismantling student encampments while ignoring violence from pro-Israel counter-protesters. In places like UCLA, the victims were criminalized while the attackers walk free. How is MPAC responding to these double standards in both law enforcement and media coverage?
I'd like to note that what happened at UCLA is a national disgrace, and every single individual, every single American should be outraged by this. Peaceful students were brutally attacked, as you mentioned, by this violent mob, and instead of protecting them, law enforcement, they stood by and then criminalized the victims. There was no sense of accountability. There was no justice. So MPAC responded immediately. We were there on the ground the day after these students were attacked. Our Los Angeles office was there. They went to the courthouses, they went to the jails, and they stood there until these students were released. We've worked with civil rights attorneys, we've worked with constitutional lawyers, other civil rights organizations, and even engaged with members of Congress to be able to essentially outline and expose what happened. We demanded that the city attorney file charges. This happened actually 2 weeks ago. We demanded that the city attorney file charges against the attackers that were there. And just days before the statute of limitations expired, because of our public affairs campaign with other of our coalition partners and our other civic advocacy organizations, they finally did. And that only happened because of sustained public pressure and organizing, which is something that we have a mastery over now. We know that if we allow these injustices to go unaccounted for, then what happens from there? So we're calling out that double standard. We all see that footage. The violence didn't come from the students in the encampment. It came from outside agitators who were allowed to act with impunity. And the media, we've seen it with the media as well. There is such a bias. Far too often, they've echoed it, casting students as extremists while simultaneously erasing the violence they endured. MPAC has continuously pushed back on that narrative and centered student, faculty, and advocates' voices, insisting on full truth, insisting on full accountability, because silence has never been an option, and we will not allow it to be an option, and neither is selective justice.
Well, Dahlia, MPAC has long worked at the intersection of national security, civil rights, and public policy. So how are you preparing the American Muslim community, and young student organizers in particular, for the political and legal challenges that lie ahead?
Thank you so much for that question. So as you mentioned, it's difficult. We all know it's difficult. And especially as the machinery of surveillance, prosecution, and political backlash ramps up against anyone who dares to speak out. Students are terrified. Advocates are terrified. The other day, we saw a judge get arrested. And that's why MPAC is investing deeply in political education, community empowerment, legal empowerment, and above all else, leadership development. We believe in being on the ground. We believe in being in the halls of Congress. We are everywhere that you could potentially find us. We have engaged with a multitude of different stakeholders in the halls of Congress to be able to emphasize the need for justice and accountability. And then through our leadership development, we have a multitude of different fellowship programs where we engage with the next generation of Americans and American Muslims to be able to learn how power works and how to shape it. We just recently launched our webinar series where we work with different civic organizations across the board from different backgrounds and ethnicities to be able to identify where we can come together and fight back against government overreach, oppressive policies, because we've identified that without leadership development, without community engagement, without that political education of what are your rights, a lot of people are left confused and they're left terrified and they're left in essentially, they become the most vulnerable. So we believe in education on every single avenue, in every single way. We believe in educating the masses, educating the community, educating our students. And we do that through our fellowships, our webinars, our political engagement. It's just very, very important that everyone is highly informed of what their rights are and resources that they have available to them.
Well, thank you for that. And as a follow-up, for listeners who want to stand with students, fight back against government overreach, or otherwise support your work, what do you recommend they do right now?
Most importantly, it's essential that you use your voice and you speak out. Using your voice to platform and uplift the truth and reject the criminalization of dissent. Second, show up. Whether that's joining the local protests, attending city council meetings, or writing to your congressional members or university officials. Third, support organizations doing the work. Groups like MPAC that are on the front lines, the ACLU who work legally, politically, and culturally. And lastly, invest in the next generation. Look into organizations and sponsor a student organizer. Mentor them, defend them, because we see that the new administration is targeting our students. And they're instilling into them a sense of fear, because they know if there's that fear, a lot of these kids are going to get kicked out of their schools. They might get deported. So they're less inclined and less likely to go protest. They're less likely to voice dissent, less likely to use their First Amendment right to speech, right? So it's essential that we empower them, because what we're witnessing isn't just a crackdown on protests. It's an attempt to suppress an entire generation and an entire movement that advocates for humanity and justice. And the only way that we win is if we fight back together across communities and across generations.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm co-host Steve Rohde. I'm joined by Maria Hall today, and we're speaking with Dalia Taha of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Dalia, we're also seeing mainstream media and university donors help push a narrative that equates criticism of Israel with hate and anti-Semitism. How is MPAC confronting Trump's legacy of anti-Muslim executive orders? He is elevating the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, which includes political criticism of Israel. We're facing the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in the Senate. Tell us about all of those attacks on free speech and public criticism.
That's a great question, Steve. And I think that it wouldn't be an exaggeration to outline that this is one of the most dangerous developments that we're actively facing right now. The weaponization of anti-Semitism to shut down legitimate political speech and dissent. MPAC has been very clear. Anti-Semitism is real and it's dangerous and it must be confronted and addressed. But the criticism of a government, especially one engaged in occupation and violence, is not hate. And we're pushing back on these false definitions in policy spaces, in legal analysis, and in media narratives. And we've also been engaging with a variety and a multitude of different Jewish organizations who have expressed the same exact thing. They will not stand idly and allow this new administration to weaponize anti-Semitism in order to suppress speech. They are these different groups that we have worked with. We've actually formed a coalition of Muslim organizations and Jewish organizations who are working to address what's going on and be able to fight back against it, because you cannot weaponize anti-Semitism in order to promote Islamophobia. From these coalition groups, we've also been working to brief members of Congress and working with civil rights lawyers to challenge universities' policies, because, as you mentioned, the IRA definition of anti-Semitism has made its way into our academic institutions and in university policies. So we have been looking and researching with these Jewish organizations positive alternatives and been working with the actual creator of the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, Kenneth Stern. This was never his intention when he created that definition. And these aren't definitions. What it comes down to, one thing that we've outlined, is these definitions aren't about protecting Jewish students. They're about silencing dissent, silencing Palestinian voices, and anyone who speaks out in solidarity. We're defending the right to dissent and insisting that free speech cannot be conditional on political convenience. And you will not use anti-Semitism to push hate, because, as I mentioned in the beginning, anti-Semitism is very real. It's a problem. It's something that we all actively have to work to address together to protect Jewish individuals and Jewish communities. But it cannot be weaponized to silence another group of people.
I'm so glad to hear you mention your coalitional work. I'm very active with Bend the Arc, a Jewish Partnership for Justice, which is part of that coalition and is clearly calling it a smokescreen to use anti-Semitism to punish free speech. As a quick follow-up, how are you collaborating with Black, Latino, Asian American, Indigenous groups to build cross-community resistance to surveillance, state repression, and criminalization? What does solidarity look like at this moment?
So solidarity isn't just a slogan. It's a strategy. It is one of our key values. It's one of our core missions. MPAC is in a deep coalition with Black, Latino, Asian American, and Indigenous organizers across the United States, because we know that this fight isn't just about Muslims or Palestinians. It's about all of us who have been targeted by the state, surveilled in our schools, and criminalized in our communities, as we've seen throughout all of these other communities. We're co-hosting briefings and webinars. We just worked with LOLAC, a very prominent Latino organization, in addressing what's happening in the Latino community and the Muslim community, and how we can come together and address what's happening while simultaneously finding strategies to work together. Because what's happening to the Latino community, and specifically the Mexican community, isn't exclusive to them. And we need to be able to best support them and come together as allies. We've also joined other national coalitions and aligned our legislative demands to be able to advocate not just for our Muslims, but for those groups as well. Whether it's ending the 1033 program, fighting gang databases, or opposing campus militarizations, in this moment, solidarity means showing up when it's not just your name on the headline. It means recognizing that our struggles are linked, and so is our liberation. That is one thing that we prioritize and emphasize within our organization. It's not just all about us. It's about other communities as well. And we need to be able to protect other communities as we protect our own. This was also seen within our UCE militarization campaign that is ongoing. We collaborated with one of our coalition partners, the NAACP, because, as we know, the violence that is often seen, the criminalization in our communities, predominantly affects the Black and African American community. So we were very grateful to be able to collaborate with the NAACP to call on the UC system to demilitarize their campuses, so Muslim, Arab, Black, African American students don't feel as if they're being persecuted and aren't facing criminalization and abuses on their campuses.
Dahlia, along those lines, as we move into the next 4 years, what's at stake for civil liberties, campus justice, and Muslim political power? And how is MPAC preparing for what's next?
Everything is at stake. Our democracy is at stake. Our country is at stake. We're entering this critical window where civil liberties are being eroded in plain sight. They're not trying to hide it anymore. From students being arrested on the streets for protests, to legislation trying to silence dissent, to government agencies being weaponized against marginalized community, our democracy is at stake. A few weeks ago, we saw Ramisa, who is a student on a green card, be snatched off the street without due process. Mahmoud Khalil, it just came out recently that there actually was not a warrant out for his arrest when he was taken in plain sight in front of his pregnant wife and then is still being detained to this day. Campus justice is under assault. And if we do not act now, we risk losing everything. And that includes academic freedom. That includes the right to organize and even the ability to safely express our political beliefs, whatever they are. That is at risk. For the American Muslim community specifically, it's not about just surviving this political movement. It's about building long-term power. At MPAC, we're preparing by developing our next generation of leaders and empowering them to not shy away from speaking the truth, from speaking up. But that consists of also educating and informing them of what their rights are. That also consists of educating and informing them of what their rights are. It's expanding our policy footprint and building our coalition partners and our work. So it's not just catered to the Muslim community. We have to be able to advocate and work with other groups and other communities and stay deeply rooted in these movement spaces. We're not just reacting, we're organizing, legislating, and shaping the narrative on who we are and what we stand for overall. What we're witnessing is this deliberate effort to collapse any criticism of Israel into anti-Semitism, and that is so incredibly dangerous, not just for Palestinians and our allies, but the integrity of free speech within our country, but specifically in our institutions. The Muslim Public Affairs Council has been actively fighting back in the halls of Congress and against legislation such as the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which is also known as AAA, and that sought to codify the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. That definition had been so widely criticized, even by the original drafter, Kevin Stern, for being overly broad and conflating political critique of Israel with bigotry. And if it had passed, AAA would have given the federal government this dangerous authority to investigate and also potentially punish students and educators for advocating for Palestinian rights while educating about Israel. So we worked with a multitude of different stakeholders. We're very proud of this collaborative effort. We partnered with J Street, a very prominent Jewish community, to educate and inform lawmakers and the community about its implications. We are a C3, so we don't do any lobbying, so we didn't go and lobby legislation, but we did actively work with our community to ensure that people were very informed on the implications of AAA and that it was essential to oppose these government policies, especially those involving occupation, apartheid, and human rights violations. And we're very happy to know that this bill has been paused within Senate, and it is presumably not going to move past Senate. And that makes us very, very pleased with our own collaborative work and our work on the ground and work with our coalition partners, that if you sit idly and allow these sorts of legislations to pass and you don't engage with your elected officials, that could have just passed. The AAA could have just passed, and who would have known what that would have meant for our country and our institutions at large. So that's something that we take a lot of pride in, is work of educating the community and engaging with legislative makers and elected officials to combat and address problematic legislation.
Dalia, our time together is coming to a close. What do you want listeners to know about how they can support MPAC's work or take action on their own and in their own communities to defend civil liberties and push back on authoritarianism? How can they reach MPAC and learn more?
You can find MPAC at our website at MPAC.org, and you can also find the Muslim Public Affairs Council on all forms of social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn, and you will be able to engage with all of us there. You see our efforts. We have a lot of action items and a lot of call to actions, but if I were to give a word of advice is start where you are. If you're a student, organize. If you're a parent, show up to school board meetings. If you have a platform, use it to speak the truth. And if you're watching all of this unfold and wondering what you can do, support the organizations like MPAC, not just financially, but amplifying our campaigns, joining our advocacy efforts, and helping us protect our communities. Authoritarianism thrives on silence and fear, and our power is in collective action, in refusing to normalize injustice, and in building the infrastructure we need to outlast these attacks. This moment demands that we're all courageous and we all use our voices to speak up and speak out. We all have a responsibility and we all have a role to play, and it is essential that we step into those roles.
Dahlia, Maria and I are so pleased to have had you today. I personally am looking forward to Rapid Response, our podcast that you and I are co-hosting. Thank you and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for allowing me for the opportunity to be on this radio show. It's been such an honor. It was such a great experience.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
One of the most consequential pillars of U.S. military power is also one of its most overlooked, our vast network of overseas military bases. In his meticulously researched book, Base Nation: How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World, author and anthropologist David Vine reveals how more than 800 U.S. military installations scattered across foreign lands are not merely symbols of strength. They often are sources of harm. From the Pacific Islands to the Middle East and Europe, these bases have become fixtures of the American empire. However, they rarely receive the scrutiny they deserve from policymakers or the public. David Vine documents how this sprawling network of bases fuels geopolitical tension, fosters anti-American resentment, and props up authoritarian regimes. He shows how U.S. bases displace local populations, pollute ecosystems, and even affect the mental health and family lives of U.S. troops stationed abroad. And while Pentagon officials downplay the cost, Vine's analysis reveals that maintaining these foreign outposts drains nearly $100 billion, that's billion, each year from U.S. taxpayers, money that could instead fund urgent domestic priorities. Perhaps most troubling is how these bases have enabled decades of interventionist wars, making it easier for the U.S. to engage militarily across the globe without addressing root causes of conflict or engaging in genuine diplomacy. We're pleased to be joined today by David Vine to discuss what a post-base foreign policy might look like, who benefits from the current system, and what's behind the emerging bipartisan calls to rein it in. A writer and political anthropologist, David was a professor of anthropology at American University for 18 years, from 2006 to 2024. He is also the author of Islands of Shame, The Secret History of the U.S. Military Base on Diego Garcia. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and thank you for that incredibly kind introduction. And I love the phrase post-base world and post-base foreign policy. You have me thinking already.
You and I will trademark that together. You write that the U.S. has approximately 800 military bases overseas, a figure you note exceeds the Pentagon's estimated count. How did this vast global network come to be? Why has it persisted so long after World War II and the Cold War?
Indeed, the United States has more foreign military bases, more bases outside U.S. soil than any country or people or empire in world history. And this is a basic and far too often unquestioned part of the United States' relationship with the rest of the world. And it's been that way, as you noted, largely since World War II. The United States government has had foreign military bases pretty much since after independence, initially on the lands of Native American peoples. Those foreign bases, U.S. Army forts, played a key role in the colonization process, the process of dispossession and conquests across North America. But the current network of indeed somewhere between 750 and 800 U.S. military bases outside the 50 states and Washington, D.C., really dates to World War II and the early days of the Cold War. The exact numbers of bases have fluctuated across time, usually in tandem with U.S. wars, but the basic infrastructure of bases has remained in place now for going on 80 years or more, indeed, because the network started around the time that the United States began getting involved in World War II. And this network of bases actually, despite the end of the Cold War, has expanded in breadth since the end of the Cold War. The absolute number of bases has shrunk since the fall of the Soviet Union, but the number of countries hosting bases has actually doubled. So now there are around 80 foreign countries and colonies hosting U.S. bases. And as you pointed out in your very kind introduction, bases have played a key part of U.S. imperial power and imperial rule and the control that the United States exercises over other countries. Although I'm happy to say that this does represent for all the really horrors and dangers of the Trump administration, this represents a rare moment where people are questioning the global network of bases and where the possibility for base closures abroad really does exist in a way that it hasn't in prior decades.
Are there any foreign military bases on U.S. soil?
No, is the short answer. When there used to be a U.S. military base in Ecuador, and one of the actual dangers right now is that there are some places where the Trump administration may want to build new U.S. bases abroad, and Ecuador is actually one. But the United States has not had a military base in Ecuador since 2009. And famously, the president of Ecuador at the time, when the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, wanted to renew the lease on the former U.S. base in Ecuador, the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, famously said, we'll sign a lease renewal on one condition, that the U.S. allows us to build a base in Miami, an Ecuadorian base in Miami, which of course is unthinkable. There actually are some offices belonging to some foreign militaries in the, maybe entirely in the Washington, D.C. area, but there are no foreign military bases on U.S. soil, nor are there anywhere close to U.S. soil. And it's actually important to, right at the outset, remember, what was the most dangerous moment in the original Cold War? It was the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviet Union dared to build a single missile base in Cuba, which nearly brought about nuclear Armageddon. It brought the Soviet Union and the United States closer to nuclear war than at any other point during the Cold War, the original Cold War. And since that time, since the Soviet Union removed its base in Cuba, there hasn't been a foreign adversarial base anywhere near the U.S. borders. Meanwhile, the United States maintains hundreds upon hundreds of military bases surrounding the borders of, for example, China and Russia and Iran and part of my concern and the concern of a growing number of people across the political spectrum, among other concerns about foreign bases, is that these bases do not protect the United States or keep the peace or deter, as they so often claim, but instead increase military tensions and frequently make war more likely rather than less likely.
Well, let's talk about some of the harms these bases are causing, which don't really get a lot of attention, particularly in places like Guam, Okinawa, and Diego Garcia.
Indeed, there are many reasons to be concerned about U.S. military bases abroad. The impacts on local people are certainly one, and it's one of the reasons I came to study and research U.S. military bases abroad now for almost 25 years. I should say this my research has also led me, as you alluded to organize with other people, again, across the political spectrum, who are concerned about bases. So these are people who work for think tanks, academics, activists, veterans groups, again, a growing number of people concerned about U.S. bases abroad. And they're concerned for many, many reasons. Most recently, we came together to write a letter to the Trump administration, calling on the Trump administration to close bases abroad in the interest of saving money, which is one easy place where people agree. It tends to be people on the left who are more concerned about the impacts of U.S. bases on local people. And as the cases you mentioned illustrate very painfully, U.S. bases have a record of displacing local people, either during the creation of U.S. bases abroad or their expansion. And the people of Diego Garcia and the surrounding Chagos archipelago, the Chagosians, are actually what brought me to study the issue and grow concerned about the issue. These are a group of people of African and Indian ancestry living in the Indian Ocean who were forcibly removed from their islands during the creation of the U.S. military base on Diego Garcia in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And the people were simply displaced, deported 1,200 miles away, and left in exile with no resettlement assistance. And theirs is a story that has been repeated in other places, in places like Guam and Okinawa before Diego Garcia. And of course, this is a story that is all too familiar to Native American peoples who, again, were displaced across the North American continent, displaced, dispossessed, and frequently murdered with the help of U.S. Army forts on Native American lands. So it's a long-standing and old story that has continued into the present, actually as recently as in the past decade or so. During the expansion of a U.S. military base in South Korea, local villages and villagers were displaced. So it is a story that has not ended. And the people of Diego Garcia, like many of the other displaced peoples, are still living in exile, still displaced, although the Chagosians, the people of Diego Garcia, are actually, I'm happy to say, closer to than ever to getting the right to return back to their islands. So it's an ongoing form of damage and one that is being resisted actively by people in places, people like the Chagosians and people in places like Guam, where people are also seeking to get their land back.
You've mentioned that the bases make America less safe. That's kind of counterintuitive. Would you expand on that point?
They do make U.S. citizens, the United States, less safe in a variety of ways. We can begin with the money that is poured into U.S. bases abroad. Just the infrastructure alone costs U.S. taxpayers around $66 billion a year. $66 billion a year. With the troops, the military personnel on the bases, we get close to $100 billion a year. And that's a budget that's larger than almost every other federal government budget. It's much larger than the State Department budget, for example. And we can also compare the number of U.S. embassies and consulates and missions, which, of course, terribly, the Trump administration wants to reduce those numbers, reduce the diplomatic presence overseas, while also chopping the State Department in half, it appears. Compare that to the 800, roughly, U.S. military bases abroad. And I say roughly because, even as you again alluded to, the Pentagon does not have an authoritative list of its bases around the world. I've been trying to track U.S. bases, and my estimate of 750 to 800 has actually been used by Army researchers rather than relying on the Pentagon's own estimate. But to get back to your question, the bases abroad undermine U.S. security and counterintuitively in a variety of ways, beginning with the costs. And of course, we can think of all the infrastructure in the United States that is so often crumbling when we have this incredibly robust infrastructure of bases overseas that, again, frequently are described as being defensive in nature. But the track record of U.S. bases abroad since World War II is very clear that these bases have been launch pads for war, by and large. These bases have been offensive in nature. And indeed, the military is well aware these bases are designed to threaten other countries. But beyond threaten, they have allowed U.S. so-called leaders, U.S. policymakers, to lead the United States into a series of catastrophic wars, from the war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia to wars in Central America to the past 24 odd years of endless war, beginning with the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, the U.S. war in Iraq, and the wars and other forms of combat in actually at least 27 countries since 2001. U.S. bases overseas have made these wars easier to wage, made it an easier policy choice in ways that, of course, have taken the lives of thousands of U.S. military personnel and literally millions of people in the war zones. So bases abroad have, in a whole variety of ways, undermined U.S. national security while also distracting the U.S. military from defending the United States, from defending the United States within the 50 states in Washington, D.C.
You've kind of alluded to this, but what role do these bases play in perpetuating authoritarian regimes and undermining democratic values abroad?
They do in profound ways. One of the frequent justifications for bases abroad dating to the original Cold War was that U.S. bases around the world spread democracy. And this could not be further from the truth in most places. In about half the countries hosting U.S. bases abroad, these are countries run by undemocratic regimes, often dictatorial and often murderous regimes, including bases in the greater Middle East, especially the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, where Osama bin Laden famously objected, along with many others, to the presence of U.S. bases in the Muslim Holy Land. Saudi Arabia still has U.S. bases on its soil, a kingdom clearly run by authoritarians. Turkey would be another example. There are examples in Africa. There's been a U.S. base presence in Thailand. And these are just a few of the examples and ways in which U.S. base presence, a U.S. base presence, ends up propping up local undemocratic regimes, giving them greater legitimacy and blocking the spread of democracy rather than increasing the spread of democracy. Of course, we need to spread democracy here in the United States, and that went before the Trump administration came into office, but even more to this day when so many of our democratic structures are at risk.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Steve Rohde. Today's guest is David Vine, the author of Base Nation, How U.S. Military Bases Abroad Harm America and the World. David, you write about the effect of these bases on the daily lives and well-being of U.S. military families stationed abroad. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's important to see the ways in which U.S. bases abroad harm a whole range of people, from locals, as we discussed, displaced, frequently harmed by crimes committed by U.S. military personnel, sadly, terribly, as has happened. Probably many of your listeners are aware of crimes, including rape and sexual assault, inflicted on people in places like Okinawa, Japan. But U.S. military personnel themselves and family members are affected by being deployed to these bases around the globe. And in some ways, they clearly benefit from having the chance to live in beautiful places like Okinawa or Italy or South Korea, and to see parts of the world, as you know, the military has famously used to recruit people. But at the same time, bases abroad, being deployed to bases abroad, have led to families being divided. They frequently, when families go with military personnel, it frequently means that partners, spouses, usually wives, have to give up their careers for their partner in the military. Children also go deploy to bases around the world frequently with parents. They too, in some ways, will tell you how they benefit and enjoy the chance to go to school on bases in places like Germany or Japan or South, not South Korea, but Italy, more to the point. But they too, you know, are separated from friends, from communities, have childhoods that are frequently broken up and disrupted in a whole variety of ways. So it's a complicated picture for U.S. military personnel and their families, but it is important to see the ways in which they are among the people who are harmed frequently by U.S. bases abroad.
Let's talk about another harm, which is the environment. What are the environmental consequences of some of these bases, especially in ecologically sensitive areas?
Bases like war are bad for children and other living things, as the, to riff on the famous poster and phrase. Bases, regardless of what country runs them and regardless of where they are bad for the environment. We just need to think about what a military base is. It is a concentration of high-powered and deadly weaponry, as well as oils, fuels, lubricants, a whole variety of chemicals and toxic and other hazardous materials. These are not good for the environment under the best of circumstances. But the record of U.S. bases abroad in particular shows that the U.S. military has frequently been a particularly bad environmental steward on bases overseas, because they can, because they have the power to ignore local environmental laws, or because the U.S. government has so much power vis-a-vis the local host government. So we see a range of environmental damage wherever U.S. bases are found, and again, including in the United States. People may be aware of the chemical contamination around the base Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Similar examples in from Hawaii to San Antonio, Texas. But abroad, there is, again, a particularly pronounced record of damage inflicted on soils, on water, on the air. U.S. bases in war zones are among the most damaging because of, for example, toxic burn pits that, again, has thankfully gotten some attention because of the advocacy of people like John Stewart and veterans who've been harmed by toxic burn pits. And thankfully, Congress did something about this. What's, of course, largely been forgotten is the impact on local environments and local people who have been equally harmed by these toxic burn pits and whose remnants will continue to harm the environment in places like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, all of these harms cost money. What's your estimate of the real cost? And you've estimated it at nearly $100 billion. How does the Pentagon obscure that figure? And where does the money really go?
Money is obscured in a variety of ways. There is sort of an assumption that is operating even among people, you know, so-called foreign policy experts, that U.S. bases abroad, they don't really cost that much. Other countries pay for them, despite, you know, Donald Trump's claims to want countries to pay more. The actual facts of the matter are more complicated and more simpler. There are only a few countries that actually help subsidize or pay for U.S. bases on their soil. Japan is one of them. South Korea is another. Kuwait. There are a few other countries that provide some in-kind donations, but not very much. But the basic simple truth is that even when countries like Japan pay to support the U.S.-based presence, bases abroad are more expensive for U.S. taxpayers than a comparable base in the United States. They are more expensive and thus, again, costing taxpayers and wasting taxpayer money that could be better spent in many, many ways.
Well, let's hopefully have a positive look at what's happening. Historically, are there recent examples of countries successfully removing U.S. bases? And what can we learn from that?
There are, of course, and Ecuador would be one where the U.S. military was forced to leave in 2009 with the help of President Correa. Another prominent case, of course, is the Philippines, where the U.S. had two of its largest bases abroad for most of the original Cold War, and the first days after the Cold War until 1992 and 93, when the people of the Philippines and the Senate of the Philippines forced the U.S. military to leave. Now, since then, the U.S. military has found ways to return to the Philippines, unfortunately. So even when a base is closed, there are ways that the U.S. military and U.S. leaders try to, or so-called leaders, try to continue to expand or return a base presence. But other prominent examples would be in Vieques, Puerto Rico, where the U.S. Navy basically destroyed large parts of the gorgeous island of Vieques for bombing and other forms of training. The people of Vieques, with the help of other Puerto Ricans and allies in the United States, forced the Navy to leave. So too in Hawaii, another case. There are cases where, for example, in Vicenza, Italy, near Venice, people were able to save a significant part of land that was originally claimed by the U.S. Army for a new military base in a town that already had six U.S. military bases. So sometimes victories aren't absolute, but people save some land from being militarized and occupied. In fact, there's a long series of examples of movements that have successfully either stopped the creation of a base or stopped the expansion of a base. And I've created a map that reflects this history of base opposition that people can find, and along with a whole series of around 28 different maps that help tell the story and expose the story of bases, U.S. bases around the world, their history, their impacts, including the environmental impacts, and the resistance that builds up so frequently around U.S. bases. Okinawa, again, where resistance is particularly well known, the U.S. military has, in the past couple decades, returned significant portions of base land to the people of Okinawa and the Japanese government. The map that I mentioned before, and all the 28 different maps, people can find them on my website, davidvine.net, www.davidvine.net, and freely download them. So people can find out more about U.S. bases abroad and their impacts and efforts to close unnecessary bases abroad in a few ways, including the network of the Overseas Base Realignment and Closure Coalition, and that's overseasbases.net, overseasbases.net. There's also a website I maintain called basenation.us, basenation.us, that in particular has information about anti-base movements and other ways to get involved in the struggle to close U.S. bases abroad.
David, you mentioned a growing bipartisan coalition questioning the need for these overseas bases. As we come to a conclusion, tell us about those efforts and the prospects of scaling back this global military footprint.
I've been part of a coalition, it's called the Overseas Base Realignment and Closure Coalition, now for going on 7-8 years, that involves a transpartisan group of people and organizations, really representing the whole spectrum from the Cato Institute, libertarians, other Republicans, people on the left who share concerns about U.S. bases abroad. And recently, members of the coalition, as well as some others, came together to send a letter to the Trump administration calling on the Trump administration to seize this opportunity to close unnecessary bases abroad to save literally billions of dollars at this time when the Trump administration claims to be interested in saving money and cutting government waste. Bases abroad are an easy place to look. And we make a number of arguments for why the Trump administration should do this. And it's worth noting, as we do in the letter, that none other than Donald Trump has been asking for years, what are we getting out of this when it comes to bases abroad? What are we getting out of having bases in Germany and South Korea, Saudi Arabia? He's asked as far back as 2016, his first run for, or his first successful run for president. So there is reason to believe and some reason to hope that again, despite the incredible dangers facing us with the Trump administration, that this is an unusual opportunity to close unnecessary bases abroad that are, again, undermining U.S. national security, harming the United States in a variety of ways, costing billions of dollars. And we are hopeful that the Trump administration will seize this opportunity.
David, I have no doubt our listeners have learned so much today. Thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder, and thank you for the vital work you're doing.
Thank you for being so kind and for the great questions and conversation.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.